This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. For women in far western North Carolina, it can be a long drive to safe and affordable maternal health care. With the closure of yet another rural hospital in Cherokee County last year, some pregnant mothers are now more than 60 miles away from in-state birthing services. And this is just another tick in an ongoing story of this country's maternal health crisis. Pregnancy and childbirth-related deaths have been on the rise in past decades, and the lack of Medicaid expansion in this state leaves many pregnant mothers vulnerable, especially women of color. So today, we're going to look at all of this and where coverage lands short and why racist birthing care persists. To begin, we head to Western North Carolina, where Blue Ridge Public Radio reporter Lily Knepp has been covering labor and delivery services in that part of the state. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Anita. How are you doing?
Doing well. So paint a picture for us about the geography of this region of the state and where delivery options exist and how this has really changed in the past couple of years with these closures.
Yeah, so the labor and delivery unit closures that we're talking about are really over the last 5 years, with this most recent closure at Erlanger Western Carolina's hospital in Murphy. Now, Murphy is about over 65 miles away from Asheville, where I am right now, and that is over quite a few mountains to get here. You know, today it's snowing, but that's not the furthest west hospital. The furthest west labor and delivery unit is in Harris Regional Hospital, which is in Silva in Jackson County, and so it's actually 65 miles from Murphy to Silva. It's even further if there are complications. The hospital that is here in Asheville has a more advanced NICU unit, and so if something is really wrong, this is the only place that people can go. But really across western North Carolina, there has been a lack of coverage that has been decreasing as hospitals like Angel Medical Center in Franklin closed their labor and delivery in 2017. Transylvania County closed their labor and delivery in 2015. And Spruce Pine also closed their labor and delivery in 2017. And now we're talking about Murphy, which closed just at the end of this last year. And with those programs, the loss of those labor and delivery units, often OBGYN care soon follows.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you mentioned it's not just 60 miles straight down 40. It's up and over mountains, very complicated drives, complicated kind of situations related to weather, so not easy. And there are some people that are trying to fill in the gaps, some OBGYNs who are traveling and trying to provide care. You spoke with someone named Suzanne Dixon. She's a practicing OBGYN in Franklin with Mountain Area Health Education Center. And I want to hear a bit of a clip for her about how she prepares patients for the potentially long trip to receive services. So let's listen to that and then talk some more.
We have had patients that, you know, they try to plan the best they can and decide they're given the choices of where they can deliver that are coming to us for prenatal care. And they plan to go to Asheville, but then they'll realize when they're halfway there that they're just not going to make it. And they'll stop at Harris or at Waynesville and have their baby. But then, you know, they're not part of the system there. Their information is not entered into the computer. And so I've been also printing out a copy of all of their prenatal labs and their, you know, ultrasound reports and everything that's happened to them in the pregnancy, and they just keep that in their glove box just in case they have to stop somewhere else to deliver, which is not ideal either. You want someone to feel like they're going to a place that's expecting them and is prepared for their particular needs.
So that was Suzanne Dixon, an OB in Western North Carolina, and I'm speaking with BPR's Lily Knepp, who's been reporting on maternal health care in that part of the state. So obviously we're going to get into, later in the conversation, the challenges of not having consistent care, not having people who know your medical record and know the ins and outs when you're in the vulnerable situation of childbirth. But for these folks that are now in this part of the state, a lot of hospitals in Tennessee and Georgia are actually closer for them than driving the 60 miles to Silva. So what are the, I mean, who's going where for these services? And are there problems with people going out of the state, Lily?
Yeah, so when we talk about Cherokee County, which is where Murphy's hospital currently is, but the OBGYN and labor delivery services are no longer over there. If you're talking about Cherokee County, Clay County, Graham County, all of those counties, it might be easier for people to get to Tennessee or Georgia. You know, there are a couple thousand women who are of the age that they can have babies out there who now are going out of state. And some of the issues with this are exactly what Dr. Dixon is bringing up. You know, they do not have relationships with the hospitals in North Carolina to the point where they can, you know, digitally transfer their files. There are issues with Medicaid transferring across state lines, dealing with different insurance across state lines. All of these, you know, artificial barriers as well as the physical barriers of the mountains and these drives that people are having to make while they're in labor, this is really what part of the issue is about when we talk about access to healthcare in Western North Carolina.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. Dr. Allison Stubbe is an associate professor of maternal and child health and of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do we know about this link between travel time and health outcomes? Why is it significant that patients could have to drive up to 60 miles to get care?
So I think there's been work done looking at the relationship between travel distance and adverse outcomes. And when rural maternity hospitals close, there are more births happening out of the hospital, not necessarily on purpose, and more births happening in hospitals that don't have a labor and delivery unit. So babies can exit women's bodies not in a hospital. That's how the species made it this far. Folks can come to an emergency room and have their baby, but that's clearly not optimal. The staff there isn't used to doing births. They're not trained for that. And certainly if there's a problem where one needs a C-section or needs pediatric help to resuscitate a sick baby, those services aren't in a small hospital without a labor and delivery unit. So that's riskier for everybody involved.
So when you hear this reporting and hear what Lily's saying about Western North Carolina, what stands out to you in terms of how it fits in with the picture of maternal healthcare in the state?
So I think one of the really important things to understand about rural hospital closures is that in states that have expanded Medicaid, rural hospitals have stayed open more than in states that have not expanded Medicaid. And the reason for that is when there isn't an insurance coverage option for folks who are not poor enough for Medicaid but not able to afford insurance, those folks come to the hospital and their care is not compensated and the hospital ends up losing money. And so if we want rural hospitals to stay open in North Carolina, one very simple policy fix is to enact Medicaid expansion, because then hospitals would be able to afford to operate.
Well, Lily, tell me more about this. You've looked into numbers about uncompensated care and the financial burden that puts on these rural hospitals.
Absolutely. So at Erlinger Western Carolina, which just closed their labor and delivery unit, they actually had Governor Cooper out to present him a resolution in support of Medicaid expansion. And they sort of put their numbers for uncompensated care at about a third of their total income for the hospital, about $17 million. And, you know, as they've decided to close that labor and delivery unit, you know, they said that it wasn't due to the uncompensated care numbers. But it's hard to, you know, hear that somebody is losing a quarter of their profits and then that they're having to make this choice that labor and delivery isn't profitable because there are fewer babies being born in Western North Carolina and specifically fewer that were coming to this hospital. And, you know, having to make that profitability choice versus being able to provide that access, I think, is exactly what Allison is talking about.
And this can be so stressful. I mean, not even just the worry of giving birth in your car, but, you know, the possibility that you could go all the way to the hospital and they say, actually, you don't need to be here yet, and you have to go all the way home, and you're trying to plan. And you spoke to an expectant mother in Western North Carolina who really lays out what the stress of that travel time can look like. So let's hear a clip from Danielle Collins.
It was stressful, but it was a little bit better than I think this one's going so far, because I'm only 34 weeks now and I'm already 2 centimeters dilated. And I'm like, oh, well, what if? And I don't have high blood pressure right now. So it's like so stressful. The fact of, can I get over the mountain in time to have a third child in hopes that we don't have any complications. But it's definitely not easy making, well, should I go here? Should I go there? Kind of decisions, because it's an hour away. With my second, we went all the way to Asheville just for them to tell me, oh, you're not in labor. It's fine. Just go home. It's like, oh, it's a whole hour home, hour and a half, really. It's a lot just to put someone through an uncomfortable ride at that, because it's not like when you're 38 weeks pregnant and you want to have a car ride, you're comfortable.
So that's Danielle Collins, an assistant teacher in Franklin County, who's now 34 weeks pregnant, talking with BPR's Lily Knepp. I'm also here with Dr. Allison Stubbe. So, Lily, what's happening to fill this gap? We talked about traveling OBGYNs. Are there any other steps that these counties are taking to provide care? Are there any models around the state that they're looking to of ways that things could be better to serve these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Danielle is actually one of Dr. Dixon's patients. And so she Dr. Dixon is only in Franklin 2 days a week. And so, you know, I talked with Danielle a little bit about some of the issues she'd been having. And she actually was at the doctor yesterday and just happened to be a day that Dr. Dixon was in town. So there really is that kind of lack of access to care. And, you know, in her previous pregnancies, she had been she had her first baby at Angel. You know, it was only 10 minutes from her house. And so that was something that really has changed for her. And so, but MAHEC, which is where Dr. Dixon works, as well as other programs, are trying to educate family practice doctors more on how to help with prenatal care and OB care and delivering babies. And we actually found a story in Chatham Hospital in Siler City in Chatham County that they're working with the UNC School of Medicine to really bring this training home to kind of help doctors integrate this care into their practice as just family practice doctors so that you can have that more full coverage. And like we're talking about, really be able to know a patient and be involved with their lives, not just, you know, bringing a folder of documents to an emergency room and having those people help you give birth.
Yeah. Well, we'll continue our conversation on maternal health as this conversation continues. Dr. Allison Stubbe will stay with me, but Lily Knepp, we're going to let you go. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
This is Embodied on the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We're talking about maternal health today. The statistics alone are staggering. Women in the U.S. face a greater risk of dying from childbirth complications than in many other wealthy countries. But most of these deaths are preventable. So what's going on? It's a complicated picture. In North Carolina, some pregnant women live far from hospitals, others lose access to care 60 days after giving birth, and others experience racial bias in the healthcare system that prevents them from accessing medication and services they need. I'm here with Dr. Allison Stubbe, a professor of maternal and child health at UNC Chapel Hill. So, Allison, you were describing a bit about this kind of tiered system of care that we can see because of the state of Medicaid in our in North Carolina. So could you take me into that a little bit more and explain how the system works right now?
Yeah, so I think something that I didn't appreciate until I've been practicing for a long time is the pretty stark differences in reimbursement for services for folks covered by Medicaid and folks covered by private insurance. So for pregnancy care for a privately insured person, for all the prenatal visits, the birth, and the postpartum care, the reimbursement is about $3,000 to the doctor who provides all that care. For a patient on Medicaid, it's about $1,350. So that's a not insignificant difference. And that leads to many practices saying, well, we're not going to take Medicaid patients, or we're only going to take a certain number of Medicaid patients because we can't afford to be paid such a low reimbursement rate. That can even lead to practices having folks lose their insurance and say, well, now you're on Medicaid, you're going to have to go to the health department. We can't take care of you anymore because we're not going to get reimbursed at a rate that we can sustain. And so those are the kinds of issues that lead to two different tiers of care. And I think I really wonder who was it who decided that a privately insured mother was worth twice as much as a Medicaid mom. Like, what does that say about how we value people?
Right. And I mean, there's a special kind of additional gap in North Carolina because we didn't expand Medicaid. So explain how that works. So with Medicaid, everyone can have pregnancy Medicaid coverage, but that only lasts up to 60 days after giving birth.
Yeah. So folks who earn up to 200% of the poverty level, 201% of the federal poverty level in North Carolina are eligible for pregnancy Medicaid. And so that is effective from when you present and say you're pregnant until 60 days after delivery. In order to get regular Medicaid, you need to be earning less than 42% of the federal poverty level. So you need to be at less than half of the level for being in poverty to be eligible for insurance coverage. If we had implemented Medicaid expansion, then up to 138% of the federal poverty level, one would be eligible for Medicaid.
So this means basically that there are groups of people who don't qualify for Medicaid before they're pregnant, who then after 60 days after they're pregnant lose
Correct.
Insurance.
And so you have to be five times as poor essentially to get insurance if you're not pregnant than when you're pregnant in North Carolina.
So what does it mean to lose access to health care after 60 days? You're 2 months postpartum. People may think, okay, at that point your baby's 2 months old. What's so bad about not having health care at that point?
So I think there are a lot of different pieces to this. One is that probably the most common complication of pregnancy and childbirth is postpartum depression. About 1 in 8 women will develop perinatal mood disorder, and that isn't something that you cure in 60 days. And in fact, that may not even show up until a month and a half or 2 months postpartum. And so if a woman comes in and is evaluated and is depressed, and we say, gosh, you know, you need psychotherapy or you need to go on medication, but oops, sorry, your insurance runs out in a week. Good luck. Then that person is left without access to care. And that's not even taking into account the limited availability of mental health care if you do have insurance. So I think that's one example. Another complication that can be devastating and deadly is peripartum cardiomyopathy. And that can present later than the first couple of weeks postpartum. And there are terrible stories around the country of women coming to the emergency room saying they feel tired, they feel short of breath, being told, oh, you're just tired, you just had a baby, and sort of kicked out without being evaluated. And then in some cases, dying of peripartum cardiomyopathy.
And what's so fascinating about this is I feel like when you say the phrase maternal mortality or pregnancy related to childbirth, I think about, you know, that immediate moment. But really, the majority of these deaths are after people even go home.
Yeah, more than half of maternal deaths occur after the day of delivery, and a third occur after 1 week postpartum. And yet, even with insurance, with all the things aligned, we see women 13 to 14 times while they're pregnant, including every week leading up to birth. We take care of them in the hospital. And then our standard is we'll see you in 6 weeks. Good luck. And I will tell you, it's much easier to be 39 weeks pregnant with baby on the inside, notwithstanding the driving to the hospital part, than having a new baby in your arms, having just gone through birth or just had major surgery, trying to figure out which way is up. And we've been saying, see ya.
And so these statistics that we've been talking about this whole time, it sounds really alarming that things are worse for pregnant mothers in the United States than in other developed countries. The rates are only getting worse. I mean, there are so many factors contributing to this, but could you kind of lay out a few of them other than access that we've talked about?
So I think access is huge. I think that we tend to silo care and divide it up amongst different folks. So if you come to the emergency department, the folks triaging women in the emergency room may not realize that having high blood pressure when you've just had a baby is much more risky than having high blood pressure under other circumstances. So one study out of University of California, San Francisco, found that pregnant women with dangerous levels of blood pressure were considered not acute when the ED triage nurse evaluated them, because if they weren't just pregnant or pregnant, it wouldn't be a big deal. And then when you get put in the not acute pile, you're left in the waiting room for, 6 hours. And then you come in and they're like, what? Why are you here? You should have gone to your primary doctor, instead of saying, oh, my gosh, you just had a baby. You could be having a stroke. And so the system is not designed to appreciate that this is a high risk group. We also see a fair number of deaths from opiate overdose. And this is a place where losing insurance at 60 days is especially devastating. If women get into treatment and are on Suboxone or methadone and are appropriately treating their opiate use disorder and in recovery, and then they lose that coverage at 60 days, then they're off their meds, they're withdrawing. And if they're overwhelmed and frustrated, they may decide to use again. And if they use the dose that used to be fine and they've been on replacement therapy, that's an overdose and that kills them.
So if we're not having this continued care in that postpartum period, a lot of those things can be missing.
Yeah, and I think if humans don't have health care, it's bad for them. Like, that's sort of the bigger piece of all of this.
Right.
But this is a particularly high-risk situation. And then we also think about the effect on kids. If mom is depressed and it's not treated, that is terrible for mom. And as a women's health doctor, that's enough for me. I don't need another reason.
Yeah.
If that isn't enough for somebody, their kid's development is potentially impacted if they're depressed and not able to engage and interact with their child.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now. Keisha Bentley Edwards has researched the ways racism affects the healthcare system. She's an assistant professor of medicine at Duke University. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell me about this kind of assertion that it is racism, not race, that influences maternal health outcomes.
Well, you know, a lot of times when you see the numbers, and fortunately people are starting to change where you say, what's your risk factor being Black? And it's not being Black. It's not melanin. My melanin is not what's causing my risk. It's how society responds to Black people and Black women. So it's not. So it's more so what is society doing to Black women is a different way to look at it when you talk about racism rather than race as a factor.
So in terms of what they're doing to women in the hospital, I know, Allison, you looked at how racism affects how pain is treated for women receiving cesarean sections.
Yeah. So one of the rising stars in maternal fetal medicine at UNC, Dr. Jasmine Johnson, led a study looking at the pain scores and pain medication provided to women after C-section at UNC. And we found that white women got more pain medicine, had lower pain scores, and had their pain assessed more frequently than Black women or Latino women. And so I think there are a lot of stereotypes around pain. There was actually a study at University of Virginia in 2016 where half of medical trainees thought that Black people had thicker skin or felt pain differently than white people. And these were folks in medical school. Hmm. There is nothing about melanin that dulls your pain receptors, just as there's nothing about melanin that makes you have bad birth outcomes. But we have a society that for 400 years has perpetuated the idea that white people are better than Black people, and that plays out in the way that healthcare gets delivered.
Well, Keisha, can you give us some other examples of, I mean, obviously perceptions of pain. Are there other examples of how race and racism impacts, how racism impacts how care is delivered?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the stereotypes that people have about Black people and Black women specifically. So we think about these societal ideas about the welfare queen, right? So even if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, rather, and you may be perceived as someone who's trying to game the system. So even when you talk about pain or you're saying that I'm exhausted or that I'm very stressed out, it may be perceived not that you have health conditions that need further inquiry, but that you're just trying to get out of working. And those are very real issues that come into play. Or your job may not believe you when you say that I have to go to the doctor's once a week or twice a week for a progesterone shot. And, you know, people have, well, my wife never had to have those, go to the doctors that often, or I didn't have to do this. And it, you know, so even when your risks are acknowledged by your healthcare professional, it may not be acknowledged by the people around you and the support that you need. So it's not just bias in the healthcare system, but also employment bias that occurs by race and by gender that also may be an impediment to your care.
Well, and these disparities exist even when class and education are controlled for,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we know that for Black women with a college degree or higher, that they have a higher risk of infant mortality than white women who don't have a high school diploma. And so we think about certain things that we call protective factors or things that kind of give you a better chance. So things like having more education. If you are a woman, an adult woman who's been to the gynecologist anytime between the ages of 29 and 35, you know that you'll start, hey, this is your golden time. Well, for Black women, there really is no golden time. There's no difference between being 15 or Janet Jackson. So those are the things.
Or Serena
that we
Williams.
Have to think about.
I mean, that was such Serena a powerful Williams. Example a Absolutely. Few years ago of how even someone with her, you know, status and celebrity can experience such racism in the healthcare system.
No, absolutely. Our advocacy for Black women, and as a Black woman, I can say I've experienced this. Oftentimes, our advocacy is perceived as having an attitude or being misguided and not really being acknowledged as being experts on our own body. And if Serena Williams, an elite athlete who gets paid millions of dollars for knowing her body, isn't acknowledged for her own personal expertise, well, what chance do I have? So we really have to really look at the systems that are in place and how we are doing our education.
And this is not only mothers. You've also looked at infants. And how North Carolina continues to have one of the worst rates in the nation for babies a year or younger dying, and the rate of Black babies' deaths is a big part of this. So what's going on there?
Absolutely. Well, this gets back to those protective factors. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes when we're in North Carolina and we think about adverse birth outcomes, we're thinking about rural communities. But even in our major cities like Durham and Charlotte, Wake County, we can see that these disparities are great. They're huge. So for a white woman in Durham County, we know that white women in Durham are highly educated. 60% have a bachelor's degree or higher. 40% of Black women have a bachelor's degree or higher in Durham County. Yet the white women's infant mortality rates are around 2.5. Black women, it's the same as the national rate at 11.5. So there's no difference. And so we have to look more closely and also thinking about what's going on the county by county, looking at Lynn Bonner's article that did the expose.
Yeah, from the NNO.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And really breaking down and remembering that one of the things that's hard when you're looking at these numbers is that you keep seeing the numbers and you want the numbers to shift, but you actually have to talk to people and see what their experiences are if you want to change. You can't change the number. The numbers represent people, which means that you have to go back to the people, because the healthcare providers, they want better outcomes,
right?
And they want better guidance. Patients want better outcomes. So we need to figure out a way and do something and not be overwhelmed by these numbers that have been stagnant.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been a lot of kind of renewed attention or focused attention in the past couple of years, I feel like, within journalism. NPR and ProPublica did a big kind of study of maternal mortality and really tried to bring those stories to the surface. And states like California have kind of become a leader in looking at how they can remap and create protocol. So what is happening in North Carolina? I mean, we talked about the lack of expansion of Medicaid. Is there anything that's being done that is going to move these trends in a positive direction? And what would your recommendations be for doing that if they're not, it's not already happening?
So I think one big positive in North Carolina has been the Pregnancy Medical Home Program, which was part of Medicaid. And Dr. Kate Menard, who recruited me to UNC, so I'm ever grateful to her, led the development of this program. And it essentially screens women on intake to prenatal care and then assigns them a care manager to help with issues like transportation, with food insecurity, with housing, with all the different kinds of challenges that can affect whether or not folks are able to access care. And we have seen a slight narrowing in the gap between Black and white women in morbidity and mortality since the implementation of the pregnancy medical home. So I think that's a really promising model. I think that, you know, one of the other pieces of this is that it is about the people and it's also about the system. And I was so fortunate to go to the Racial Equity Institute's training last week, and they talk about this metaphor that if you're walking along Jordan Lake and you see a dead fish in the water, you're going to think, what's wrong with that fish? But if you're walking around Jordan Lake and the whole lake is full of dead fish, you're going to think, what's wrong with the lake? And so often when we talk about interventions, we think, well, gosh, if we assign a case manager to all of these patients, we'll make it better. Well, yes, the case manager can navigate the problems those mamas have, and we need those case managers, don't get me wrong. But we also have to ask, why are all of these women in need of case management?
Right.
And why is it that, you know, minimum wage is $7.25 an hour for a family of three with one working parent? The living wage in North Carolina is $28 an hour. Wonder why people are living in poverty. It's not that they're not working. It's that they can't make a living wage. And so I think we really need to step back a minute and think about, what kind of state do we want to live in? Do we want this to be a place where families thrive? And if we do, we need to make some pretty big changes that are beyond, that include but do not stop at what happens in a healthcare encounter.
Well, and healthcare is such, there's such a huge, complicated web of intersecting, you know, everything, intersecting systems, that social determinants of health and people's, you know, immediate access. I wonder, Keisha, for you, I mean, have you seen any good examples of attempts to kind of look at a systemic level at decreasing these kind of disparities in healthcare in particular?
Well, I think right now we're in a prime moment where we can thank Serena Williams and Beyonce for talking about their birth outcomes, and then also the woman who worked for the CDC who passed away, who was a health disparities expert herself. And so I think that we're in a moment where you have a lot of stakeholders who have power in the systems, who are willing to have the conversations. Also, and you have providers who are also wanting to be a part of this conversation. So things as far as system-wide in Durham, you have Family Connects, which is a program that does home health visits. And that is for every woman who gives birth in Durham County. So I think a lot of those broad-based programs are helpful. But I think the other aspect that needs to happen is that, because these are racial disparities that are not only about poverty, so Medicaid expansion is important, but we have to acknowledge that this is a racial issue, which means that you have to look at Black women with disaggregated data. So look at Black women specifically, but also figure out, what are the things that need to happen to support Black women? We have to talk about toxic stress. We have to talk about domestic violence. We have to talk about employment discrimination, not just when you're pregnant, but beforehand. We also have to talk about preconception. Those are the issues that need to be addressed. And we have to think about not just the system approach as far as making sure that the hospitals are in good communications with the OBGYN providers, because that's often a source of disconnect, where a woman, as you said, sees, I know I saw my doctor, you know, three times a week in the last month that I was pregnant. But when I got to the hospital, there were all these new people who didn't know me
yeah.
and didn't understand that if I say I don't feel well, it means I probably feel horrible, you know? So those things, as far as making the systems work together and communicate well, and so that we're all on the same page, because when you have poor maternal outcomes, when mothers are dying, when babies are dying, it's indicative of larger issues in our health and in our society as a whole. And that's what we have to address.
I feel like that's a big mic drop there, but I'm going to let you, Dr. Stube, if you have any closing thoughts about the systemic problems.
So I think another really important policy fix is paid family leave. And Duke led a study looking at what it would look like if we enacted paid leave insurance in North Carolina. So this is not a handout. This is an insurance one would pay into, like unemployment insurance. And they found that if we enacted paid leave, there would be 26 fewer dead babies each year in this state. And so I would call upon the folks in the legislature to think about whether they are in favor of 26 dead babies or opposed to 26 dead babies. And if they're opposed to 26 dead babies, I would urge them to take up this legislation and enact it.
All right. Keisha Bentley Edwards is an assistant professor of medicine at Duke. Dr. Allison Stube is a professor of maternal and child health, as well as obstetrics and gynecology at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.